Hi, this is Jeff Siegel, the wine curmudgeon. My guest today is one of my good friends in the wine business, a tremendously fine human being, and especially because he put up with us at Drink Local Wine in the old days, Michael Wang Bickler of Balzac Communications in the heart of the California wine country. Mike, thank you so much for doing this.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks a bunch. Yeah, it's been a while, hasn't it?
It's been entirely too long. Basically, Mike, your agency is one of the leading wine marketing companies in the country. And I wanted to talk to you. You have as good a view as anybody about what's going on with wine, about what's happening as we come out of the pandemic. You've got a particularly unique view because people are paying you to push their wine, so you have to know what's going on. How do you see what's going on as we come out of the pandemic?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting, and it's always fascinating to see the prognosticators, you know, make predictions about, you know, what's going to happen. So interestingly enough, you know, I think that the issue with COVID and the epidemic really exposed a lot of weaknesses in the wine business in general, but especially in wine sales and marketing. And the nice thing is that I think that, you know, it spurred innovation on the part of a lot of producers to look at new and creative ways to market their products and engage with their customers. So, you know, things like moving to more digital programming, you know, focusing more on their websites and their DTC experiences, you know, making sure that, you know, their club members feel like they are actually getting the value from their clubs and et cetera. So that's a definite trend that we've seen and we expect to continue. I think there's going to be a continued effort on the part of wineries to enhance their DTC experiences and programs so that they have a closer engagement with their customers, right? So, and obviously because of the closures of so many restaurants, you know, the on-premise business for wine in particular really dried up, you know, for a year. People were still selling, you know, like to-go cocktails and wine by the bottle, but it still wasn't quite the same. So a lot of businesses had to, a lot of wineries had to shift their focus away from on-premise to more off-premise and DTC. And so that's a trend that I think will continue. I'm uncertain as to how quickly the restaurant business will bounce back from this or even what model it's going to follow moving forward. I think there's definitely going to be some changes there.
Let me back you up a second. I interviewed a guy, a mainstream marketer, a general consumer goods marketer, earlier this summer, who during the pandemic went to work for a winery in California to do just the sort of things that you were talking about, Mike. And since he'd never dealt with wine or the alcohol business before, he was flabbergasted at the three-tier system and the restrictions on how to sell wine. One of the things that we've seen is some loosening of restrictions in some states about making it easier for consumers to buy wine online and over the internet. This guy said he thought that was, it was just going to have to, the restrictions were just going to have to fall away just because they were so out of date. And I, of course, laughed at that because they've been out of date for 70 years.
Yeah, exactly.
But what do you see? Do you see the restriction, the loosening of restrictions and some of the reforms? I mean, we're about as wide open in Texas now as we've been since Prohibition, which is saying something since the end of before Prohibition. Do you see this coming or do you see kind of a backlash in which some of this stuff is going to be taken away?
I think it really depends on the state and the political climate in each of those states. I don't think that's going to open the floodgates because there's just too much inertia in the business, you know, and especially, you know, when it comes to that three-tier system, the biggest beneficiary of that three-tier system is going to be the distributors, right? Because they're the guys in the middle, and basically they are making their money from the imposed restrictions, basically, you know. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with them wanting to protect their business. And they've spent a lot of resources, both time and money, you know, in trying to do that. So they have a lot of political clout, more than any individual winery, for instance. And even individual wineries like that might have that kind of clout, like, let's say, Gallo, right? They don't really have a vested interest in opposing the current system, because actually the system benefits them very well. So I think that we're going to see what we saw prior to COVID, and that's just a kind of a gradual easing in particular areas where the political environment is conducive to having a more open and free market in that particular area. Right now, you mentioned Texas has been more open since Prohibition. You know, it depends on which county you're in. And it also, you know, the question is there incentive for, you know, the Texas government and the TABC to ease the restrictions that they have in place? And I'm not sure how to answer that, but my inclination would be to say no.
Man, you made my day, Mike. We got the TABC in a podcast on a wine curmudgeon. For those of you who don't know, it's the Texas Alcohol Beverage Commission, the Texas Alcohol Police, who get to carry guns. And as the late Louis Cantaloupsis once said, after the guy came into his bar, just shook his head and muttered under his breath, and because he did not want the guy with the gun to hear it.
Well, you know, they're revenue officers, basically. I mean, it's like the same as Illionesse back in the day.
Yeah. Right. And that's a very good point, because, you know, we still have bootlegging here in Texas.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's hard to believe.
There's bootlegging and moonshiners and all that. Yeah.
Exactly. So are we going to, there's been a lot of debate. Are we going to have this big wine bump? Are people, as we come out of the pandemic, are people going to go out and buy more wine? Are they going to buy something else? Are they going to buy more expensive wine? How do you see this from your perspective?
No. Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, there's been discussion about a wine bump. And I think that in terms of wine tourism, that's certainly true. You know, that in terms of wine tourism is up a lot. You know, that, you know, basically, I've talked to a lot of people who have tasting rooms and visitor locations for people to come and taste their wines. Traffic is up sharply since, you know, the easing of the pandemic. That's where I think there's this pent up demand, and people want to go out and enjoy, you know, a day of wine tasting. Does that mean that alcohol beverage sales are going to increase overall? I don't think so, because I think that before the pandemic, we saw a trend of people drinking less, right? Especially, you know, the younger generations, they're actually drinking less alcohol overall. That said, they're also drinking better, right? So they may be drinking less in terms of quantity, but in terms of quality, they're drinking more. So they're not opposed to spending a little extra money to drink a better product. But in addition to that, we've seen a lot of beverage alternatives that have emerged. And I think that those are going to continue to grow, whether in their current form or in a future form. You know, this includes things like, you know, hard seltzers, right? Which, you know, basically have many fewer calories than a glass of wine. And, you know, the kind of better for you type of wine movement is going on, as well as this, you know, this non-alcoholic spirits type of emergence as well. So I think that's a trend that's going to continue I don't think that we're going to see the, you know, basically Generation Z and millennials drinking the same way that the baby boomers did, or even the Gen Xers did.
No, the great, to me, unreported, unanalyzed, undiscussed story in all of this is the idea of young people drinking less. I'm old enough to remember when you became of legal drinking age, the very first thing you did was go to a liquor store and buy as much alcohol as possible. And that's almost unheard of these days.
Yeah. Like, and when I turned 21, we went in a bar crawl.
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't drink. And the drinking age in Illinois was 21. It was 18 in Wisconsin. All my friends and I piled in a car. We drove to Wisconsin when I turned 18. And I just bought it for them because it was just such a rite of passage. I didn't drink then. Who would have known?
Yeah.
But is this just a cultural change? Is there a reason why the wine business can't wrap its head around this, or am I missing something? And everybody does actually understand it, but doesn't know what to do.
Well, again, I don't think you can treat the wine business as a monolithic entity, right? So certainly there are those within the business who are slow to change, right? And for them, you know, they're farmers and they've been farming the same way for 50 years, and you know, they've weathered many storms and they'll weather this one as well. And that may be true. But I think that there is a certain recognition among, you know, certain set of the industry that recognizes that, you know, habits are changing and people are looking for different things. You know, for an example of that would be like, you know, when we look at a brand like The Prisoner, right? So, Within the kind of, you know, Illuminati of the wine business, there aren't a lot of fans of The Prisoner, right? But the fact is that, you know, mostly I think because of style and probably what it represents. But the fact is that what The Prisoner does is it offers the consumer an experience that they can't get in other wines, right? It's something that's a little bit counterculture, a little bit edgy. And then, you know, especially like if you look at the new visitor center that they basically converted the old Franciscan visitor center to the Prisoner. And they've got like, you know, a really interesting kind of customer experience for people who visit. And I think that's what we're seeing more and more of. And I think that those wineries and wine companies that adapt to the new environment by offering those kinds of experiences are going to continue to grow and excel, and those that don't, you know, they're probably going to be bought up and broken up, or, you know, we saw today, you know, I don't know when this is going to air, but today San Michel Wine Estates was purchased by a private equity firm for $1 billion, right? So I think that we're going to start to see a lot more of that. I think we're going to start to see more equity coming into the business, and I think it's probably going to start to see a little bit more maturity as an industry.
And that's interesting too. You talk about the Chateau Saint Michel deal. That was a company that was perfect. If you had looked at the last decade, the last 15 years, it did everything right. It was highly respected in the wine industry. It had brands to cover every base, and all of a sudden, boom, they're gone. Which is, again, without getting too dragged down into economics, the mark of a mature industry in which all the original money has already been made. And now it's time for the people who made the money to sell so somebody else can take over the business. And I think you're right. I think if this deal is actually what it seems to be, that's exactly what's going to be happening.
Yeah. And, you know, this is not really a new thing. I mean, we've seen this time and again over the last 50 years in the wine business, where basically, you know, we have brands that emerge, they become very popular. You know, they're sold off to some, you know, mega corporation. The mega corporation operates it for a little while and then decides that they can't make any money doing it, and so they sell it off to somebody else. That's been happening, you know, forever. So, you know, the old adage of, you know, how do you make money in the wine business? You know, how do you make a fortune in the wine business? A large fortune, you start with a small one. So, you know, or small fortune. No, sorry, gosh, you know,
you got
screwing up the punchline. You know, that's like Radio 101. Okay. How do you make a small fortune in the wine business? You start with a large one, right? So it's basically, you know, we do this, and the wine business is what it is. And the reason we do it is for the passion of it and because we love this product, not necessarily to get rich.
Oh, I can attest to that. Mike, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. I should mention that as soon as we finish recording this, which will be in a moment or two, I'm actually going to record with Mike for his podcast, and I'll have the link to that in this one on the page. Mike, thank you so much for doing this. It is a pleasure, and I apologize. We really should have done this a long time ago, but I guess when you're just, you know, too busy and important and famous people like we are, it's hard to get together, huh?
Right, right. Yeah, that's it. That's a ticket.
That's it. Thanks again, Mike. This is Jeff Siegel, the wine curmudgeon. So long until next time.
All right.